Hi, guys, and welcome back to the IBS Freedom Podcast. I am joined by our local resident, awesome dietetic master, Amy Hollenkamp, R to the D.
Hey, everyone.
And today we're going to be talking about a subject that's very near and dear to both of our hearts, probably especially Amy's, and that is food reintroduction. Let's kick it off, my dear, because this is probably your favorite topic, I would imagine. That and maybe the under-eating topic are your two favorites, if I had to guess.
Yes.
So I'm going to kick it off to you, and then I will chime in from time to time. But if I may, maybe let's frame the conversation for starters, that there's going to be, like, food reintroduction, like, if you do an elimination diet and you don't know if foods are triggering for you, right? Like, you do a Whole30 or you do AIP or you do whatever, and then there's the reintroduction strategy where, like, you're literally waiting to find out what's triggering for you and you're looking for, like, an allergy or sensitivity. And then there's probably what's more common amongst our listeners is going to be, like, you have done the low FODMAP diet and now you're trying to strategize how to reintroduce either carbs or FODMAPs or fiber or complex carbohydrates or something like that.
Right.
But I think that they're slightly different, at least in my opinion. So let me preface with that and then I will kick it off to you.
Right. It's almost like when I think of reintro and usually who we're working with, I think most of my clients get in a dietary rut. And there's like a mindset, a huge mindset piece that you want to jump over, a huge hurdle from a mindset standpoint that you have to get over because you're mentally trying to wrap your head around bringing back in these no foods again. They've been labeled as no foods.
Yeah.
And then I think, again, there's also this physical hurdle as well where your body hasn't been eating these foods for a while that can be a little bit challenging to overcome as well. So you have, you're balancing the mental and physical sides that can come up from a reintro standpoint. And I think, you know, just zooming out, there's so much talk about restriction. I mean, you know, everyone has their flavor that they prefer. Maybe it's SIBO specific, maybe it's biphasic, maybe it's low FODMAP. Like, there's all these different restrictions. Some people go low carb, some people go paleo, whatever it is, everyone's sort of veering more towards the restriction angle. And again, that might be helpful short term to do low FODMAP to kind of calm things down and things like that. But there's so much less focus on the reintro. And low FODMAP is designed to have a reintro phase. But I find that a lot of the practitioners that are using low FODMAP don't necessarily know how to implement it properly, but like the proper implementation of low FODMAP is there should be an end where you are reintroing foods to see what your body does well with. But I just find a lot of times the prescriber is not a dietitian or not someone that's really guiding. It's more like, oh, here's this list of low FODMAP. Stay on this forever. And there's no discussion around reintroduction or how to expand the diet. And that is really sad and heartbreaking, I think, because, you know, you're just not getting guidance. And again, you're already probably freaked out of foods if you're getting a yes and no list, let alone not really getting guided on how to reintro or being told, you know, this is the goal. The goal is to reintro and to have a broad array of foods that you're eating, and that's just oftentimes not discussed or on the radar from what I've seen.
Well, and you have a good point. I think, like, you know, when you're kind of coming up with a strategy, you could zoom out and say, what was the proposed purpose of the elimination? And what is the possible mechanism of the reactions that I'm watching out for, and what is the end goal? Like, and I'm going to say something controversial, but I think you're going to get what I mean. In a weird way, you might be better off just being labeled with IBS and never actually getting the diagnosis of SIBO in this regard, right? Because, like, a person with IBS could go to the GI doctor, be told that they have IBS, be told, hey, do low FODMAP for a while, let's book you with an appointment for a dietitian, and then at least the dietitian is going to lead the person through the elimination and the reintroduction, and at least there is some effort on that, because it usually in my finding that world, it's not, the automatic assumption isn't that FODMAPs are evil or carbohydrates are evil. It's just that there's like a tolerance difference between individual and individual. And they just know that people with IBS oftentimes don't tolerate some of the FODMAPs. So it's like, they'll help you get back to that, at least reintroduce a few of them. But with SIBO, like, if you get that additional diagnosis, it's like, if, and heaven forbid you go to a functional medicine provider or somebody who's gut savvy, and then it becomes this game of you have to do low FODMAP because if you eat a FODMAP, it will feed the SIBO and the SIBO will win and you will lose. And oh my God. And they're literally painted as evil.
Right. So like,
why would the goal be to reintroduce an evil food? Like, it's right, like saying,
right.
It's like saying you need to eliminate lead and arsenic and cadmium, but we're going to have you test them all again and see which ones you tolerate.
Right. Like, see which
nobody
poison.
Would do that. Yeah, right. Like, see which poison you can tolerate. Like, that would never happen. But I feel like that's the difference between the two worlds. It's like, at least if you just get labeled with IBS, at least there's some hope that you could wind up in a dietetic office and you could try to work towards introducing some of the FODMAPs. And then if you don't tolerate one of them on reintroduction, usually it's just like, okay, that one's a never again thing. But at least you got back a few of the foods. But like with SIBO, it's this black and white, absolutely not, never, ever, no, red, bad food list. And then it's like, well, so wait, I reintroduced bad foods? How does that make sense?
Right. Right. No, I love that analogy. You're so right. When you start bringing in the, because I sort of view it, you know, the RD space is looking at symptom control.
Yeah.
So, you know, when the goal is symptom control, mm-hmm. that's more of something to work with. But when the goal is starving the SIBO.
Guerrilla warfare.
Right. It creates a lot
Burn
of problems.
Bottom.
Right. A lot of problems mentally and physically, too, if you're eliminating foods for a long period of time. And I also think that, you know, most RDs, I would hope, with beyond hope, that most RDs, their top priority is nutrition. And I think that a lot of times that's not necessarily the top priority of a functional practitioner all the time.
I agree.
So, you know, it's a real bummer. I get super frustrated, and I'm sure you do too, like working with people who have been on low FODMAP for 6 years with no end in sight, super freaked out of foods. And slowly working on building up variety again. But it's frustrating that it can take that long to kind of figure out. You don't have to be on this long term. And that's not the, that should never really be the goal, is to be restrictive long term.
When I am the one to prescribe low FODMAP, which is not frequent, but when I am, I usually tell patients, you know, we'll have you do this to mitigate symptoms for a few weeks or a few months.
Yeah.
And then we'll start to reintroduce, kind of like dip the toe in the water, see what you tolerate. And then eventually the goal is to reintroduce most, if not all, of those foods, maybe with the exception of gluten or dairy, depending on the situation, like if you have autoimmunity or something. But, you know, you should be able to eat those fruits and vegetables again, certainly.
Right. And I think, you know, another aspect of this too, that we talk about all the time, is you have to look at things from a pro and con standpoint. Like, there's not just pros when you're eliminating food. There's a lot of cons. No. So you have to weigh what makes sense. And again, you were saying gut savvy practitioners will say, like, starve the SIBO. But you can't just starve the SIBO. It's not like these diets are working in isolation where you could just, you know, starve those little SIBO bugs in there, but also feed the other bugs. Like, you're starving everything out. And so, you know, it's the total lack of understanding from that side of things too, I think, is very frustrating. Mm-hmm. It's kind of myopically looking at, like, okay, we can starve this out, when there's no research either that really says you can starve SIBO out.
Not that I've seen.
Yeah. And I always
symptom mitigation, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of IBS studies on low FODMAP and those sorts of things. But yeah, there's nothing that's showing, you know, that you can starve SIBO out from a dietary standpoint. And I also think it's really interesting, and I know we're gonna be doing hydrogen sulfide as our next
episode,
but like there was an interesting study where they had people do low FODMAP, maybe it was for like 2 weeks, I don't think it was super long, or do a prebiotic for 2 weeks. So they had two groups. I think it was randomly controlled. Well, I guess it couldn't be random if they were on low FODMAP, but they were on low FODMAP or prebiotic. And they did it for 2 weeks, and they looked at symptoms. So it wasn't really measuring SIBO per se. But they also looked at the microbiome as well. So like what was going on in the microbiome with those two groups. So symptoms mitigated with both groups. So with a prebiotic, so they're feeding the SIBO and the other gut bugs.
Feeding and starving got the same.
Right. And then starving. But the interesting thing is when they took people, like at the end of the study, they monitored their symptoms beyond the intervention. So low FODMAP, the symptoms came back relatively quickly. Prebiotics, they had more sustained relief. So the symptoms didn't return. But the crazy thing to me is that I always butcher the name of this bug, but Bilophilia wadsworthii. Is that how you would pronounce it?
So Bilophilia wadsworthii.
Okay. I've always butchered that. But that bug went up in the low FODMAP group. Which I think's interesting from like a sulfur standpoint. I wonder again how these like low FODMAPs diets affect like hydrogen sulfide. And again, that same study said lower bifido bacteria in the low FODMAP. So you have these ramifications.
Very consistent.
From a microbiome standpoint, with starving everything out, and again, is that really a good mindset to get in based on the data? Like, I don't think so. I think, again, like from a symptom control standpoint, restricting for a period of time can make sense, but not from like a starving out standpoint.
It's not, I guess one way to think of it is that trying to starve SIBO isn't actually addressing the root cause.
Right.
Because it's, you know, you can quiet down the SIBO and you can mitigate symptoms for that period of time. But like the moment you look cross-eyed at an onion, the SIBO blow is just going to come right back because you didn't actually address the reasons why you got SIBO to begin with. If eating onions guaranteed that you would get SIBO, everybody would get SIBO. So clearly, like, that's not the variable that made the difference in you getting SIBO. It had to have been, again, like, you know, preaching to the choir, but like your motility broke down somehow, like your vagus nerve tone sucks for some reason, your MMC isn't working right, like you've got post-infectious IBS, you've got low stomach acid, like there had to be something else that caused you to become intolerant to these perfectly healthy foods. So why are we demonizing the foods and cutting them out and labeling them as like bad or red or no foods when it's not the freaking food's fault? Not in this case, not in that context.
Right. No, you're 100% right. And I think it feeds into the narrative that we were saying earlier. Like, when people are saying it's a food problem, so if your practitioner is like, oh, you have to be a low FODMAP forever, whatever it is, they kind of freak you out in some way. If you're getting that messaging and then you're trying to control every symptom diet-wise, like, it would be natural to be like, oh, I'm just going to stay clear of onion because when I do eat it, I get a symptom and I'm feeding this. Like, it feeds into the narrative that they're trying to make. And, like, you're exactly right. They're jumping over the root causal part of the conversation and just totally failing that and putting it in someone's head that they can manage their SIBO with diet.
Yeah.
When it's just not that simple. Diet and clearing, usually, I would say, is the biggest
killing it, starving it.
Right. And And I think getting to, like, reintro stuff, like, I think from a reintro standpoint, typically when I'm working with someone, I'm trying to get a really good gauge of what their level of food fear is pretty early on. So I'm trying to get a gauge of, like, are you going to be someone where I'm like, okay, let's put a list together of, like, 5 to 10 yeah. foods, and you're going to be totally fine doing that? Or is it going to yeah. be a little bit more slow go, and we're going to have to do some mental, like, mm-hmm. some mental exercises to help? Yeah. yeah. So, and again, I've definitely seen a wide degree of people. Like, some people have a little bit of food fear, and it's pretty easy to, like, bust through that, and they're kind of off to the races.
And, like, once they gain some momentum, right. like the first one or two wins, then that can yeah. kind of vaporize for some people.
Right. And then there's, again, other people that, you know, it's just a lot, I think, more intense of fear and anxiety. And some of the things that I generally feel like helps when there's a heavy degree of mental hurdle and food fear is mm-hmm. going on, are things like, I really like visualization. I don't know if you've ever used that.
Do tell.
Yeah, but like having someone, if this week the goal is for you to introduce asparagus, mm-hmm. sitting down, closing your eyes, maybe in the morning or something, the morning before you're going to try it, or doing a couple visualizations with this, but mm-hmm. sitting down, closing your eyes, like visualizing yourself, sitting down, eating the food. Who are you eating it with? Like, trying to make the visualization mm-hmm. as real as possible.
Yeah.
What does the food taste like? Kind of visualizing yourself in the first person eating this food. Even visualizing yourself after feeling good.
Yeah.
Like, playing out your day a little bit with mm-hmm. that food having gone well. And matching that with, like, the emotion you would feel if that occurred. So, like, mm-hmm. grateful, thankful. And then you kind of come out of the visualization. Yeah. So it's really simple. There's not necessarily rules to it. But I think doing, like, the mental exercise of walking it through mm-hmm. can ease the actual real life experience a little bit.
Yeah.
It's
like a dress rehearsal before you get right. to the big show.
Right. Exactly. I really like visualization practices. So that's one. I think... sometimes I'll have people write down the fears that come up. So, like, if they're really freaked out of, like, asparagus, again, mm-hmm. using asparagus. Sorry to pick on asparagus, guys.
It's because I have it painted on. Oh, yes. Where is it? There,
yes. Though? Is that's, that a new? That's why. Is that a new work?
Relatively, new... yeah. I added a couple. I'm slowly growing this wall.
Nice.
I'm going to run out of wall space eventually, but not yet.
But, yeah, I think... from an asparagus standpoint, like, if that's a major fear, one thing that you could do is, like, track the fear. So jot it down. Let's say you think that the asparagus will feed the SIBO. So you can write that down. I usually have, like, a little sheet that people can use to write down what mm-hmm. their fear is coming up. And then next to it, reframe that fear. Mm. So, like... actually, asparagus is feeding my good bugs, or maybe asparagus is really delicious, and I used to do really well with asparagus. So, like, you can kind of reframe it, but I think if you can put those two together, and you can kind of see where you're mentally at right now, and where you want to be, and a reframe that would serve you better to yeah. reaching the goal of reintro, and then, so you, typically this worksheet, I can send it to you. It has three columns. So you write your
kind of... because I'm writing it down on my little list here as something that I need to think through here.
Yeah. So it's like your fears, your reframe, and then on the right, I kind of, the rightmost column, I'll put, like, how are you going to reinforce the new belief?
I like that too.
So again, sometimes that's visualization. Sometimes it's reminding yourself, oh, like, asparagus tastes really good, looking up the health benefits of the food, actually, like, putting it in your planner that you're going to go buy the food, like, having little steps to kind of yeah. help you get there mentally. Yeah. So Yeah, I mean, I think that for some people, doing these exercises can be really helpful because it lets you see where you're at currently. It lets you kind of reframe, like, what's a better belief that's going to serve you towards getting to the goal of reintroing your foods, to broadening up your microbiome, to broadening up your nutrition. So I really like stuff like that. I really like, you know, I was mentioning health benefits, looking those up. So it's not just you're being fed, this is going to starve the SIBO. You can get build new beliefs and thoughts around the food. Because no food is all good or all bad. Even ice cream or, you know, foods that have sugar, like, they taste amazing. We enjoy them. We have a shared experience with people when we're eating them. So it's all about, you know, reframing your beliefs and thoughts. And that helps ease the mental and physical hurdles, because if your thoughts are, you know, not in a great place, that can drive some symptoms. So doing the mental work beforehand, I think, can really help with reintro. And some people may need to do more of this mental reframing, and other people can pretty quickly, like, they build confidence up in a shorter span, and they don't really need to do as much. It's more of a natural flow to reintro.
It's like how intentional you need to be with this stuff versus, again, like, some people, they might be a little bit nervous, and then they introduce one or two foods successfully, and then they're like, oh, okay, this is going great. Yeah, for somebody who's been on a restricted diet for potentially many years, it can be downright terrifying to introduce foods. And, you know, it's like, it could make the difference, honestly, between not even how smoothly the reintroduction goes, but whether or not you do it. Because I've had appointments with patients, and I'm sure you have too, where we talk about reintroducing a food or two, and they seem down, and I'm down, and I think, great, I'm going to cut them loose for a couple weeks, and they're going to reintroduce this food, and then we'll talk about it. And then the next appointment comes around, and I'm like, so how was the blah, blah, blah? And they're like, oh, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
And they check it out. And it can make the difference between, do you get the guts to do it, A, and then B, when you do it, what happens? Like, does it go smoothly? But if you psych yourself out and freak yourself out and get hung up on how this food is going to hurt you and the symptoms, then there's a much higher likelihood that you're going to get unpleasant symptoms. And it could be completely unrelated to the food. Like, did I tell you my story about when I thought that I got exposed to dairy and I royally freaked myself out?
Yes.
Dear God. And that happened a good 8 or 10 years after I did a lot of my gut healing. At that point, I would have told you that my gut was in good shape for many years. And it's still like that kind of background little bit of like PTSD was still there from my previous experiences, where I just needed that little seed to be planted. And then my brain just let it bloom into a big tree and took it away. And like, I had bloating. Like, I thought I was going to have to unbutton my pants at a professional conference. How could that have been? And royally freaked myself out. Like, I could feel my gut cramping. I could feel the bloating. I could see the bloating poofing up. And then the moment I found out that damn yogurt was made with coconut milk and not cow's milk, everything vanished. And I went back to normal, and I was like, son of a gun. Like, it makes you feel like a crazy person, but I know I'm not a crazy person. It's just, that's what the nervous system is built to protect you. And if it thinks for some reason it needs to protect you from a perceived threat, whether or not it's a real threat is up for grabs. But if it perceives a tiger, it's going to do things to your body unbeknownst to you. And you need to be aware that your nervous system might take you that direction and try to control that and be aware of that. And I think that's why I tell a lot of my patients too, just like acknowledging that the fact that you're in my office right now probably means that you have some element of medically induced PTSD.
Yeah.
Like, either from having symptoms that are unpleasant or painful, that already is going to induce a trauma response, probably, and like trauma brain. But then, heaven forbid, you hop from practitioner to practitioner and you get dismissed and misunderstood, and you spend a lot of money on supplements or medicines or procedures that don't actually help you, and you're frustrated and burnt out and depressed, and like all of that is like, take a second to acknowledge that you probably have a bit of trauma brain, and anybody else in your position would have trauma brain.
Yeah.
And just acknowledge that, like, that means that the nervous system can kind of take things away from you without you fully being aware of it if you're not careful. So just like kind of checking in and even seeing like, all right, I'm about to have this meal with the asparagus. How am I feeling right now? Like, do I need to take a minute and just do some deep breathing and close my eyes? Do I need to take a minute and like excuse myself from the table and go, you know, lie on my bed or sit on the couch and do some deep breathing and then come back to the table? Like, is, you know, is your heart racing and beating out of your chest, or is your chest feeling tight, or is your stomach already crampy and bloated, or are you, you know, are you feeling freaked out even before the first crumb touches your lips? Because if so, kind of take that moment, see that that's where you're at, and then take control of the steering wheel and say, no nervous system, thank you right. for trying to protect me from a perceived threat. I understand that you think this is a threat, but my frontal lobes understand that this is just asparagus. So right. I'm going to steer the ship over here, and we're going to take a minute to breathe and kind of chill the fuck out first so that the asparagus and I can have a nice interaction instead of a shitty one. So, yeah.
Right. Right. PTSD. And I think what you're describing too is like the fear is very real with yeah. reintroing these foods, and it can have a very real effect on your biology.
Yeah.
And it's not
illogical.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
Like, and it makes sense.
It does. It totally does. And, you know, typically when I'm talking to people about reintroing things to help with, like, sometimes it's like, well, what the heck am I supposed to start with? Like, that's always the question. And I think it's interesting to me because the more I work with clients, the more I see this, and it's a common thread, but I'm sure you do too. But at the beginning, it's always like, what do I introduce first? Like, it's like almost like you tell me what to do because I don't trust like myself with the process. Yeah. And then as it goes on, it's a fun experience to see them being like, oh, I added this in, like, or I've added this stuff in, and it's stuff that they're building confidence and their ability to tolerate things. So I love that process. But typically if someone's like, oh, what do I add in first? Like, I'm a little bit nervous. Typically the rule of thumb that I'll give them is like, what's something that you maybe took out that you didn't necessarily have a strong reaction to? Like, can you think of some of those foods?
Yeah.
And then two, what from that list would you be excited to add back in? Like, kind of do those two,
you're
like,
kindred
rules.
Spirit. I love you so
yes.
much.
Well, I love you too, Nikki.
It's,
we're having a moment here.
So we are. We're having a moment here. But really, like, I think that's perfect. Like, was there a food that you probably were told to cut out by a practitioner or a list, right? Did your functional medicine doctor or your whoever scare the bejesus out of you and tell you that you absolutely could not eat broccoli, but you knew damn well that your body was fine with broccoli? Try that first. Like, it's pretty simple when it boils down to that. And then, yeah, like, what will bring you joy? Like, I talked to a patient yesterday. One of the very first things she reintroduced was avocados, because she lives in Texas. And I remember in the first appointment, it was a teenage girl and her mom, and both of them were like, look, we live in Texas. We live for guacamole.
Oh,
like,
yum.
We would eat guacamole with every meal every day of our lives. So this low FODMAP thing is really hard. Do you think she could eat guacamole again someday? And I said, absolutely. And that was the very first thing that she reintroduced was avocado, and then eventually onion and garlic. And now I talked to her yesterday, and she's like, I'm eating all the things. She still can't do gluten. Gluten still messes with her. But she's like, I'm doing everything else and I'm loving it. So it's like, all right, I'm not going to tell that person, oh, you should try to eat an apple first, because she doesn't give a shit about apples.
Right, like, right.
Avocados were where it's at. But I have other patients who yearn to eat an apple, especially in the fall when it's like apple pie season and apple picking season. Sometimes people just really want apples. Do that first. I don't know.
Right.
Follow your heart.
Right.
Man.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, follow your heart, man. That should be our next hashtag. T-shirt idea.
Hashtag, Hashtag follow your heart, man.
Yes.
I think, for sure. Now I'll throw this out there for you. So that I basically have a similar method to you. That's why I was like, oh, I love you so much, because we both kind of do the same thing without ever, I don't know if we've ever actually talked about that necessarily.
Yeah.
But we basically have a similar strategy. But I've had some patients, again, the people who are really freaked out about food and have been on a restricted diet for several years, I've had a couple patients where they actually didn't love that approach so much. They needed something that like felt more scientific in a weird way.
Yeah.
So like I remember one patient, for example, and she's done really well. She's made a lot of good progress. And we've talked the whole time working together. We've talked about reintroducing foods, and she's nervous, but like she wants to do it. It's just she has to get over the hurdle to get there. And this was one of those cases where like we would talk about, okay, reintroduce these two things. Let me know how it goes. And then we would talk again. She hadn't done it. I was like, what's going on, man? And we'd talk, and then same thing would happen a couple of times. And then last summer, I think, I posted a video on my YouTube channel about using the FODMAP acronym as a tool for reintroducing and going through it systematically and like trying, basically you can try to find foods that are only in one column, because sometimes people will pick up on, oh, my body for some reason really hates polyols right now, but the oligosaccharides are fine and, you know, the monosaccharides are fine. Or maybe you have an issue with the fructose monosaccharide foods, but the other ones you're fine with. So when I sent that to her, and she was like, actually, I really like this method. It feels more sciencey and it feels like more methodical. Like, oddly enough, if you're really freaked out about food and reintroducing, it can feel, and she wasn't my only patient that had this feedback. A couple of people ended up liking the other system ultimately. But it's like, it can feel just a little bit willy-nilly or like too good to be true.
Right.
To say, follow your heart, man. Like, you want an avocado, you eat an avocado. You
follow
go
your
gold.
Heart, man, method is true.
Yeah, yeah. Again, we'll hashtag it. But, like, that can feel too froofy for some people. Mm-hmm. And they want, again, it's like they don't trust themselves. And they don't trust their ability to make the decision.
Right.
So they would much rather just, like, somebody give them the perfect list or the master list.
Right.
So that's an alternative. I much prefer the method that you described. Like, start with the things that you're pretty sure you don't have a reaction to, or the foods that would just bring you a great deal of joy, and then start with those things. But for those of you, and maybe it's like maybe the more left-brained, analytical, organized, hyper-organized people of the world, maybe it's them. But like some people I have ultimately recommended, I'm like, okay, don't follow your heart because you don't trust your heart.
Right.
Here's the chart. Pick one of the columns and you start looking for foods that are only in one column. So like cauliflower versus, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example. There are some foods though where you're like, oh, it's in all of them. So that wouldn't work. But you know, just pick and go by.
Pick a lane and then go down that lane until you figure it out. And it's interesting you say, you know, I've definitely seen variation in how people want to maneuver the reintro. One of my favorite cases, and this is going to be a little different because she was younger. She was like maybe around 24, early 20s. Okay. And she, with the pandemic, she moved back home to live with her parents. And she was like, kind of the opposite of what you were saying. Left brain is like hyper over analytical. She was annoyed with like the whole process of trying to choose. So she, like, on her own, we were talking. She's like, yeah, I've been introducing. And I'm like, oh, like, what kind of stuff? And she's like, well, I just eat whatever my mom makes, even if it's a small amount. Like, she didn't want to do all the mental thinking it through, like, which foods.
Yeah.
She just was like, every night there's something a little bit new from a vegetable standpoint. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a little bit and gradually build up. And I'm like, that's amazing, too. Like, you know, if you want to sort of take some of the control away and give it to someone else and just sort of mentally prepare yourself each night you're going to be trying something new that your mom makes for dinner or your spouse makes or whatever it is. I think that's an interesting, like, idea, too. I've, like, thought about maybe, like, suggesting that to a few more people who are just, like,
It's
trying to control, like, they aren't loving the analytical side of the process. They want it to be more of, like, a flow, and that's something that worked for this client pretty well, and I've always just thought about using that a bit more and how I could potentially use that as a practitioner and found it interesting.
Yeah. It's fascinating because usually, and I married somebody who I would deem to be fairly left-brained and quite analytical. Like, his training is in engineering, so the nerves of the world. And it's funny because my experience with more, like, analytical, left-brain, organized people is that they have a hard time relinquishing control. So I'm really impressed with her that she was able to do that, because, like, the kind of control-freak, left-brainy, engineery types that I know, I don't know if they would have it in them.
Well, and that. I don't even think she was left-brain. Like, I think she was, like, maybe not left-brain, and that's why that strategy really worked for her. Okay. Like, she was so just like, I don't want to... Right, maybe. But it was more like she just didn't want to have to use mental power to, like, engage in the process. Mm. She felt a lot more comfortable relinquishing that control and allowing someone else to take the lead for her. And she could just rise to the, like, dinner table occasion and sprinkle in some new foods. Each time that she was going to dinner, which, again, I just thought was, like, it goes to show you that there's general rules of thumb that I feel like work for my clients, but there's always room for, like, nuance and different things to work for different people. And I found that kind of a fun way to reintro.
I guess another way too, would be, you could do something somewhat similar, but with restaurants. I had a patient kind of recently, maybe 2 weeks ago, and it started out as a bummer because I think this was only our second or third appointment together. And I was like, so how are you? I have some shticks, but, like, lately I've been opening a lot of conversations with, how are you doing? How are you feeling? What's new? What's different? What's the same? Tell me all the things. Yeah. And I don't know why my brain is really like that lately, but I said that, like, tell me all the things. And she was like, well, and it's kind of started out as like, well, I'm not feeling any better. I'm not feeling any different. And I was like, it's a bummer. And we started talking. And then towards the end of the appointment, she revealed, she was like, yeah, but you know, it's weird. She's like, I think that a lot more of this is stress related than I realized. I'm like, do tell. Like, come over to my side. We have cookies. Tell me more.
Right.
Admitting that is huge. And she said, yeah, because, like, there was one night that, like, she was getting home late and she and her husband didn't want to cook. And they were like, just screw it. I think the husband was like, just go to Chipotle and pick something up at Chipotle and, you know, and come home. And so she did, knowing that, like, none of those foods she had eaten in quite a while. And she was thinking it was going to aggravate her IBS. And then it was totally fine.
Yeah.
Completely. And she had, like, beans and veggies and, like, onion and garlic and like all the things, and she was fine. And she was like, huh. And she was like, I felt really good. I felt the most normal that I have in a long time. And then similarly, there was another point where they were, like, out and about for the day and they didn't have any food, and they were like, oh, let's just go to Chipotle, or Chick-fil-A. Let's go to Chick-fil-A. And she got, like, the breaded chicken sandwich and, like, fries. Absolute garbage food. Or maybe it was a grilled chicken sandwich, I forget, but she got, like, a chicken something or other and fries, and she said it was great. I felt the most normal I have in a long time. I had absolutely no issue with it. And it's like, it was kind of making her, like, confused in a way. She was like, meanwhile, I eat, like, this clean, like, organic whatever at home, and I get diarrhea and bloating. But we unpacked that, and actually, one of the things that came of that appointment, I was like, okay, new official homework assignment, new prescription, if you will, is to get dinner with your husband once a week or every other week. Like dinner that you don't cook, that you either pick up or you go to a restaurant. I think maybe one of those situations, they actually went into the restaurant. But I was like, that's now part of your homework, is maybe you just need to kind of like remove yourself from the home environment where you have so much control and you've been so rigid with your eating. And you just need to like take a day, like once a week, and just like enjoy the experience of going out with your husband, enjoy your food, and order something off the menu that looks delicious. And for no other reason. Like, yeah. I don't care, you know, if you want to get the organic whatever salad at the restaurant one day, cool. If you want to get only cheesecake one day at the restaurant, cool. You do you. And I'm anxious to hear how she does with that. We only talked about a week or two ago, so I'm anxious to hear how she does with that. But that was part of her prescription was, all right, you go out and eat something at a restaurant and eat something that looks delicious and just have that once a week or every other week. And then I forget what else we altered about her plan, but I think that could be valuable too, is just if you're kind of mentally exhausted at the thought of adding things in, order takeout or go to a restaurant and get like a curry or something that would have some veggies in it and just enjoy the food.
Right.
Don't obsess about what the ingredients are of the food, but just enjoy that food and then see how you feel. And it might be that your body takes that in and is like, yes, I've been waiting for this.
Right.
So that's maybe a little bit scary to introduce multiple things for some people, but it can be helpful.
Right. It's funny. It's like your go with your heart method. We've discussed that one. I feel like it's like a let your hair down method. Yes. If you had to like hashtag it.
Yep.
And I think that can be incredibly valuable. I know through my own experience, like thinking back to reintros, mm-hmm. and like, I almost think it's like let your hair down in like an F it type attitude. Like, yes, F the diets. I'm going to go like do me at a restaurant.
I'm going to live my life.
Right, right. And I think that there is, I remember like vividly having like it feel like going from here down here. Like a very visceral like relaxation.
Yeah.
Of like, okay, I'm letting everything go and I'm enjoying this meal. It's not something that I've eaten in a while. And I think talking about pros and cons of things can sometimes resonate as well. And thinking about that, like, in almost accepting a little bit that you could have some reactions, which I know we've talked about too. Mm-hmm. But like, if you had a reaction and you really enjoyed a food experience, like, there's still pros there. And did the pro outweigh the con?
Yeah.
You can kind of discuss that with yourself. And I think that measure, like thinking about it in that way can be helpful for some people. And I will say as well, with the accepting how you're going to respond to reintro, super important. From what I've experienced. So like, you could potentially have the symptom and that's okay. In a lot of cases we've talked about before, if you haven't had that food in a while, your body has to adjust to it.
And your microbiome.
Right.
If your microbiome hasn't seen a morsel of fiber in 18 months, then give it a minute.
Right. If you've eaten low carb for a year and you're adding in carbs, like, your body needs to bump up amylase and enzymes that break down starch or whatever it is. Like, your body's going to adjust to different nutrition and your body and your microbiome. So recognizing that and accepting that, I think, makes reintro a lot smoother.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll give people, like, a general guideline of, like, well, if the symptoms, like, a 5 or above, it's something to maybe pay attention to, like on a severity scale. If it's like 5 and under, it's probably a normal, or 4 and under, it's probably a normal reintro type symptom. So, you know, having an idea that, you know, some mild symptoms are to be expected and there might be like,
I think don't even want to call them symptoms. Like, okay, how about changes?
Adaptations, transitions.
Yeah, like, yeah. You might get, I mean, we would normally call them symptoms. So, like, bloating or, like, cramping.
Right.
Or, you know, I think that, you know, indigestion.
Right.
I would totally normally label those symptoms, but it just occurred to me, maybe the way to phrase it is you could have some mild to moderate changes or adaptations.
Right. Yeah, I like adaptations a lot.
It's to be expected. Again, like, your microbes haven't seen this food in a long time. Your pancreas and your gallbladder and your stomach and your small intestinal cells haven't made these enzymes in a long time. They probably have a teeny bit of amnesia and they have to remember how to do it now. And it'll take a couple of goes before you start making these enzymes again. Even hell, lactose. Like, that's something I think that's been pretty well proven in research, if I remember correctly, is like, if you take somebody who is not lactose intolerant and you have them cut out lactose for a long enough period of time, their body will forget how to make lactase. It's like, the body's not dumb. Like, your body knows, oh, I don't need to make this anymore. Psh, cool. I'll save my resources and I'll do something else. But, like, for me, you know, I went dairy-free because I figured it was the casein protein that really instigated symptoms, supposedly for me. I didn't have any symptoms of lactose intolerance at the time. Yeah. But I haven't eaten dairy in about 10 years. So now I'm probably lactose intolerant just because my body hasn't seen dairy in 10 years. And my, you know, I'm not making lactase anymore,
right,
I'm sure.
Right.
And it's okay. Like, it's, you know, I'm not going to touch the stuff because of the protein and my immune system hating it anyway. But, like, if I did get the bright idea to try to go from no dairy for 10 years to I'm going to eat ice cream at, I don't even know, like, a place that sells ice cream. I don't know if it would go so hot because I probably have induced lactose intolerance now.
Yeah.
And that probably can happen to some degree with other enzymes, but then the body can kind of realize, oh, we have to make the enzyme for the thing because there's a thing. We never thought we'd see this again. Holy shit. Right. And then off you go.
Right. 100%. No, I think you're dead on. There is an adaptation process, and I kind of like to describe it too as experimentation. I think wrapping your head around it as big experiment and what foods work for you are going to be different than maybe what foods work for someone else. And that list can grow and change and evolve. It's not like, you know, what you tolerate right now is what you're going to tolerate in three or 4 months when you address root causes and other things. Yeah. I mean, it's always changing.
Exactly.
Which I think's like, if something's constantly evolving, I find personally it can be harder to wrap your head around versus, oh, like, I wish it was as simple as these are the foods that I do well with, these are not the foods I do well with. But yeah, I think it's constantly evolving. And I think it, you know, even over like what works for me now might not work for me in 5 years. Maybe I need a little bit more carbs. Maybe my needs change as I do different movements and intensify my movement, or after I have a baby or whatever it is. Like, I do think
exactly
it needs change. And when you address root causes, you can expand the diet a lot more too. And again, it's such a key piece to this because so many people go heavy on the diet. Like, they expend so much energy and resources on the diet because it's so strict. And then they fail to address things like stress. And the actual engagement in the diet stuff makes stress worse. So I do think, you know, I'm glad you brought it up earlier. It's so important to recognize that, you know, the diet piece is, and having kind of removing things that you might be triggered by, it can help symptom-wise, but not necessarily address the root causal aspects that are going to allow you to expand and build tolerance to a lot of different foods. So there should always be a consecutive action of like, oh, you're reintroing while we're kind of adding in some root causal support. And I actually think too, like, in some ways broadening things up could be helpful for addressing dysbiosis, which again is a root cause. So, like, I don't think cutting foods would address a root cause, but adding things back in could certainly address some dysbiosis and imbalances and be more root causal for sure. Yeah. But yeah, I'm trying to think of if we have anything, if I have anything else to add. Go ahead.
I have another nugget that I'll throw out there I have one useful thought and then one that's just kind of random and weird, but I'll throw it out there anyway. per our usual kind
we need a few rando things thrown out.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we always deliver. Let's be real here. But you know, it's like, and now I got sidetracked on the weird. I have to tell you the weird thing now, because now I've actually forgotten the other thing and my brain got too excited about the weird thing. So when we were talking about how your brain might need to increase production of like amylase or digestive enzymes or like lactase for a food that you haven't seen in a while, and don't get too freaked out if there are some mild to moderate changes or adaptations, like, don't automatically think, oh god, I'm feeding the SIBO, oh my god, I'm doomed, and this was a bad idea. It's kind of like, here's the weirdness, it's kind of like if you did ballet as a kid, and then you did not do ballet your entire adult life, and then at the age of 64, somebody told you, get up on that stage and dance, I don't even know, the Sugar Plum Fairy dance for me.
Right.
You would be like, what? I have not done that in a very long time. What are you talking about, Edward? And you would have to, like, you'd have to, like, watch a YouTube video at the very least, right? And you'd have to think, like, okay, and then what, the pirouette here and the plie, and then you would get up there and you would do a real lousy job, let's just face it. No matter how good of a ballerina you were at 17, if you haven't done ballet in a long time, you're gonna suck when you get up there. And it's kind of to be expected. You would never look at that person who did ballet until they were 17 and then did nothing and then at the age of 64 got on a stage for the first time in ever. You wouldn't look at that person and be like, oh, this was a bad idea, you really sucked, Wendy. You would just be like, oh, you're out of practice. That's okay. You go, man. Like, good for you for trying. But also, take the time between now and the next meal or the next performance or whatever. Take the time to, like, watch a YouTube video.
Right,
and, like,
right.
Remind yourself what third position looks like and remind yourself how to, like, bend your knees appropriately to do a plie because you look like shit up there. But, like, you would never, like, take it out on Wendy, right? So don't be that person. Like, don't, you know, throw in a new food that you haven't eaten potentially in months or years. Have a little bit of, like, changes that you don't love and gas bubbles, and then think, oh, this was a bad idea. You failed me, my gut. Why do you hate me so much? Like, don't be that person. It's okay. Right. Just take a couple of deep breaths, you know?
Well, you bring up some good points, and I love your metaphors, and I also love that you use names like Wendy and Edward.
Edward, yeah.
That really brought the story to life.
Right, it gave it a whole new dimension, I thought.
Right, right. A couple things you mentioned that I think are very important. So, and it came up with me recently. I got an email maybe a couple weeks ago. I have a client who, like, was a little apprehensive. We were talking about, like, when they're a little apprehensive, but then they, like, get confidence. So she, like, got a lot of confidence, and then, so I get this, like, longer email that's, like, oh, I tried a lot of foods, and, like, you know, it was going really well, and she's, like, and then I think I, like, went overboard. Like, it was just too much, and then, like, I had a flare-up. So she, gained a lot of, it was like a roller coaster. Like, first she was, like, unsure, but then she's, like, oh, this tastes so good. Like, her and her husband were, like, experimenting, you know. It was a cute, cute email, and she was, like, oh, I, like, feel so bad. Like, did I, like, mess things up? So I basically put in the email, and whenever I get anything like this, I'm like, you should be proud of yourself for trying
totally
new foods. Like, you were really freaked out. So I think that's a really big win. And I think what you mentioned in that story about Wendy is, like, you should encourage yourself and speak to yourself in a positive manner when you're trying new foods. There should be a level of, like, being proud of yourself in some way. If you've been fearful, give yourself a pat on the back for even trying something, even if it doesn't go as planned.
That's even still buying the asparagus, like, give yourself that dopamine hit and tell you, right, like, you go, girl, you bought asparagus. Yeah, you did. Like, that's still something.
Right. And I think one other thing, too, you mentioned, which I could bring up. And again, this is I still think it's on topic, but sometimes boosting digestive capacity, you were saying, like, we were talking about enzymes and things like that. Sometimes doing digestive support when you're, especially if you're increasing calories, I mean, that's a big thing for a lot of my clients. Like, even the process of increasing calories, maybe it's not one food or the other, but usually to increase calories, if someone's restrictive, we're doing both a jump in calories and probably adding some things in, like doing both. But doing a couple things, whether it's like bitters or enzymes or HCL or whatever it is that might help with like digestive capacity.
Or just giving yourself like 2 times the amount of time to eat your meal.
Right.
Like if you're used to taking 10-minute lunches, give yourself a full 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know? Just give yourself more time to process. Even that.
For sure. For sure. But yeah, I think like that can be a beneficial thing to focus on digestive capacity.
I thought of the thing, by the way. So when you're done, I thought of the thing.
Yes, tell me. Hit me.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
With your best shot.
Da, 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 da. so this is another thing that comes up with patients pretty often too, again, around like the food fear and the food reintroduction stuff, is, you know, the quote that I think is attributed to Einstein, but you know, the internet does not do well with attributing quotes to the right people, but I think it might be an Einstein quote. Maybe. I see it on memes on social media all the time, but you know, that quote where it's like, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity. I would not necessarily say that's the definition of insanity, but you know, like there's other things that are insane beyond just that. But you know that quote and that saying. So sometimes I bring that up because people are, you know, they have this mental hurdle and this fear because they're like, every other time I tried to reintroduce, it didn't go well and I'm really terrified of it. And I usually make the point, if all of the variables were exactly the same and you were trying to reintroduce the food and you were expecting a different result, then that would be possibly kind of silly, right? But the variables are no longer the same because you're working with me and we're doing new things, right? Like, I have you on and then, you know, we'll talk about the protocol. Like, hey, we now understand X, Y, and Z because of your test results, and we have you doing X, Y, and Z based on that, and you're already feeling X amount better. And you know, it's like I have to sometimes paint the picture of how you feel like it's the same, because in our brains we only perceive our body as our body, and it's very easy to get stuck in like, well, I have tried it before and therefore if I try it again the variables are the same, it's still me, so it's going to go horribly. But it's like, your situation's not the same. You are taking 3 new supplements and exercising for the first time in years, and you're chewing your food better and like listening to my amazing podcast with Amy, and like there's all this stuff that has changed now. So you don't have to worry about that Einstein quote. You don't have to worry about that definition of insanity stuff because you're not doing the same thing anymore. It's totally different.
Right.
So sometimes even just that, when I explain that, people will be like, oh, yeah, okay. Even if you just introduced like a new antimicrobial, like, hell, even that's something that's a different variable and that's changed it enough that you can expect a different result, possibly. Even if you add in one new thing, or if you've introduced one new food, or if you've introduced one new habit, or you've decided to like chew your food adequately for the first time in your life, like even one change changes enough stuff that now the variables are no longer the same, and you could be reasonably you can feel not silly to expect a totally different result, and you can it's like I give you permission to have that optimism because now things are different, right? So
no, I think that that's there's a couple things that came to mind when you were talking about that. I'm glad you were bringing that up. I think, you know, also I tend to remind my clients, like, is low FODMAP or whatever diet you're following really working? Like, it isn't really providing you awesome relief, like, amazing relief.
Yeah. Do you feel normal?
Right. Like, right. Oh, yeah. And I think thinking that diet's going to get you there is not necessarily the best frame of mind, as we've discussed. And I also think you brought up something really important, too, that, you know, diet isn't the only thing that's going to help symptoms or create symptoms. So a lot of times I'll talk to people too and like almost get them wondering like, okay, you had this reaction to a food. And a lot of times it's like, sometimes I react to this food and sometimes I don't. And it's like, well, there's other variables there. Maybe it's not the food that's creating the reaction. And sometimes how I'll actually get people to clue in on that, and it's not necessarily... it's slightly different, but I'll have people track their good gut days, like their better than average days.
Yeah.
Instead of getting so hyper-focused on the symptoms, instead being like, let's change and go the other way. And like, if you're having a better than average day, what factors in the last like 24, maybe even 48 hours do you think could have played into your better gut day? Did you sleep more? Did you... laugh with your husband? Did you go on a walk? Did you eat at different times? Like, was your pattern a little different? What was your stress? Were your stress levels different? Like, anything that you could think of that might have played into it. And I think instead of getting as hyper-focused on the symptoms, sometimes even focusing on the good changes that are happening or the good gut days, and what contributes can actually help divert focus to the things that help versus getting hyper-focused on the symptoms, which can be really, like, I just think a lot of times it's very hard to say this thing is driving this symptom because there are so many variables. Yes, you can. Like, I do think that there's clearer instances where you could say, okay, this is the only new thing I added in or the only change. But I think a lot of times people get like super hyper vigilant, linking any symptom to any food. And I think acknowledging there's more pieces to the puzzle, and some, if you find that you're that person, like you just feel like you're hyper vigilant, putting maybe your vigilance on the good, like the better gut stuff, might be a different framework to try. Sometimes I'll even have people do this, like, even if it's just like a little, a journal or even just a little tick mark of like, oh, I had a better than average gut day. They write one bullet point of like what might be at play. You can see how many good gut days there are in a month. So you can see how it affects over, how things are affected over time. Which is interesting too. Like, my goal is always that, like, you have more good gut days.
Yeah.
The longer we're working together, and you can kind of see that over time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a,
I like that.
Yeah. It's a good tool. I think, especially if people are, if my clients are, if I can tell they're very hypervigilant.
Yeah.
And they're really nervous about symptoms and things like that, changing the lens in which they're looking at things can help.
I think it's very, like, it's very understanding, and it's nice, because I do think that with anything mental health related, so like hypervigilance and like that, oftentimes will go hand in hand with people who are quite a bit more anxious and high strung and tense about their symptoms and their situation. And again, for good reason, like a lot of these people have medically induced PTSD, like it makes sense that they would be anxious and tense and freaked out and hypervigilant. But I think it's like, it's an easier ask instead of saying, hey, you hypervigilant nervous wreck person, don't be a nervous wreck anymore and stop tracking all the stuff. And it's, again, like I think that a lot of anxious, tightly wound people, when they're in that space, they have a really hard time releasing that control.
Right.
Because they feel like, whether this is incorrect or not, they feel like that control is the only thing protecting them.
Yeah.
And like, the world is out to get them, the food is out to get them. And they feel like, well, no, oh my God, like, I can't drop my guard because right. then all the boogeymen will get me. So it's so much easier to say, hey, tightly wound person, like, take all that hypervigilant kind of behavior and, like, that urge to track all the things, understand all the things, take that behavior and just place it over here instead of the kind of, like, it's the difference between saying, that's a bad behavior, that's a bad thing you're exhibiting, stop doing that, itty-poo on you. It's the difference between that and saying, you can keep the neurotic behavior, just, like, move it over here a little bit, right?
It's like positive, it's almost positive reinforcement versus negative reinforcement.
Yeah.
In a sense. And I think there are times to do some symptom tracking. Like, I have clients that, like, and usually it's something that is really, they've noticed more randomly, like maybe it's a rash or something that comes and goes. Like, those instances, maybe jotting a few things down might make sense. But, like, I get a little bit leery of people that are tracking every day, like, every poop, every, like, you know, situation. If they are the anxious person, like, I think that that puts way too much focus on everything that's going wrong.
Yeah.
Versus maybe some of the things that are going right. And even just changing that lens helps you see that it's not all bad. There's some good stuff mixed in. And maybe this month you have 5 good gut days or better than... I always like labels. Sometimes people, again, just don't... Are like, I never have a good gut day. But it's like, I would consider better than average for a lot of people that I work with. Like, something that you would track. And again, maybe this month you have 5. Maybe next month you have 10. That would be like a big jump. That would be awesome. Yeah. Like, maybe the next... The next month you have 20, like, that'd be even better. So, like, it's all about, it's a good way to track progress too. Especially, like, if you feel like you're kind of like a day-to-day person where you're like, oh, my gut's still weird, like, you know, I think tracking over a longer period of time is a much better
point.
So gives you a better gauge.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point too. Another thought comes to mind that I think we should touch on, and then I feel like we've covered a lot of really juicy stuff in this episode. I'm really looking forward to getting this one out there for our listeners. Going back to my original thought, at the very beginning of this episode, I mentioned that there are different reasons why people might be reintroducing. So let's talk for just a second about the pace that you could go at. And I'll weigh in first, and then you can agree or disagree or weigh in if you want. Typically, if I'm suspicious of a food sensitivity, so say, for example, if somebody comes in and they have 3 autoimmune diseases and, you know, and they have like joint pain and migraines and Hashimoto's and psoriasis or something, like, say if they have this like inflammatory autoimmune squirrely clusterfuck of stuff going on, that's the person where maybe the conversation is less about like FODMAPs and carbs and fiber. Maybe that's a case where like, all right, let's just have you do a trial run of like basically paleo, like grain free, dairy free, give that just a month or two, and then we'll touch base. For those situations, if you're looking to see if your immune system freaks out at a food and see if you get a sensitivity type reaction, I think the normal recommendation is to wait about 3 days between items. And this, you know, I don't know if anybody does that, but that's the ideal, because you could take a day to generate the antibodies and generate that immune response. But like, I think that it's important to go a little bit more slowly with those sorts of things. So if you do like a whole 30, to this day, I don't think I've met a single human being who has done a whole 30 the right way. Because everybody does the super strict elimination for the 30 days, and then their brain goes, I'm done! And then they, like, eat everything all at once. And it's like, well, that's not really the point of a whole 30. They kind of, a lot of people treat it more as, like, a cleanse for 30 days, and then they kind of are done with it. I don't think I've met a single person who's actually done it the right way yet. But theoretically, if you do something like Whole30 or Paleo and you're looking to see if something ticks off your immune system because you're like an inflamed autoimmune pile of goop, then for you, you're probably going to want to reintroduce a food every 3-ish days and kind of dip your toe in the water. And I always have people start with the least suspicious items first. So like, if you don't really think your body has a problem with grains, try the grains first. If you don't think your body has a problem with dairy, try dairy. But like, usually I'm having people wait until the very end to try gluten, because that's kind of the wild card for a lot of people, especially with autoimmunity. Versus my IBS and SIBO patients, if I'm having them reintroduce FODMAPs or carbs or fibers, honestly, sometimes I'm having people reintroduce a new thing every day or every other day.
Yeah.
If you have a reaction with the FODMAPs, like, you're going to know about it pretty quickly. You're going to eat the onion or whatever it is, and within 20 minutes or a couple of hours, you're going to get the nasty SIBO symptoms of the bloat. Like, you're going to know about it pretty quickly. So you could theoretically, like, eat the new food at lunch on Monday, and then at lunch on Tuesday, you feel like you're back to your baseline, and then you could test another food, perhaps.
Right.
So usually, I think the pace, you could go quite a lot quicker if it's more about, like, IBS, SIBO, IBD kind of stuff that you're exploring, as opposed to the autoimmune inflamed people who are hunting for, like, weird immune reactions. That's kind of a whole nother thing.
Right.
Bugs react quick. Immune systems take a little bit of time. So that's my take, at least.
No, I totally agree. I think the pace also depends, I think, on the person, too. Like, again, if they're really freaked out, sometimes I'll just be like, let's do, like, one new food each week. Yeah. Like, pick, this is your sweet potato week. Like, you're going to take some time to, like, maybe have, like, a sixth or a fourth of a sweet potato, like, the first day. Maybe wait a day in between just to, like, calm your system down if you need anything. If not, again, you can always bump up faster. I think, again, I play it by ear a little bit, but I think if I have someone that's a little bit freaked out to add stuff in, usually I'll start with, like, you know, each week in between our sessions, add a new food in. Sometimes I'll even tell them, like, which foods are you gonna, like, I'll have them list the ones that they're gonna add in so I can specifically ask them about it. But yeah, I think going, like, if you're nervous, I would go on a weekly basis and sort of, like, test. And again, once you build up confidence, I think it's a lot easier to do it more quickly, and it should be less of a problem. You know, the pace should be less of a problem. But I think you're right. It's not necessarily like you're going to have this delayed immune system reaction to onion. It's more you're going to have a more acute response. Or, you know, a few hours after or whatever.
Like, within the window of time where your body and your microbiome is trying to process, digest, and absorb that food, that's when you're going to see the difference, primarily.
Right.
So, you know, what does it take food to reach the colon between an hour and, like, 3 hours for most people? Like, that's kind of your window for most of the stuff. Versus, again, like, if you have migraines or if you have rheumatoid arthritis... Like, I know for my mom, she has very early stage RA, and on a day-to-day, it's very well managed, it's in remission, but if she gets glutenated, her joint, this knuckle, will hurt the next day. It's always the following day. So she'll go to a conference, pre-COVID times, of course, but she'll go to, like, a conference for work, come back, and she'll be like, yeah, I think that the breakfast they served might not have been gluten-free, I'm really suspicious. And then that next day, by the time she gets home, she'll be like, yep, I knew it.
Darn. My little gnarly knuckles acting up again.
Yep.
Oh, no.
Ooh, she should get a tattoo. My gnarly knuckle.
Oh, she should.
Yeah. I'll rub that by her.
She should get a tattoo that says, if it's not gluten-free, my knuckle, tell me. And then, like, show people at restaurants. Really freak them out.
I love it. Or make a card, be like, here's my card. Actually, I remember that was the thing for a while there. I don't know if it still is, but sometimes there are, like, cards that you can get, like, laminated that say, I cannot have the following foods. And it's a list of, you know, you can have them custom print it. My goal for all of you listeners is so that you don't have to have one of those cards.
Yes.
Like, those, that is a whole new level of, like, wow. Trying to function in everyday society with that kind of a card. Again, it, sometimes it makes sense, whether you're hyper-allergic or, like, have an auto-inflammatory response, or whether you have massive IBS flare-ups from every FODMAP on planet Earth. But, like, you can approach normalcy again. It's just a matter of, like, how you get there for each of those cases. But I would hope that all of our listeners don't have to go down the road of having a pre-printed up, custom-made, laminated card with all of the foods that they cannot have so that they can send it back to the kitchen and tell the chef about their food stuff, because that does happen.
It's funny you bring this up, because I was literally staring. I grabbed it on my desk. Armand, when we started dating, had made a card that he would give women. It says, professional cuddler. And then on the back, I don't know if you can read it. It says,
world traveler, avid lover of brunch, outstanding gentleman, weakness when it comes to animals. That is the most amazing thing I think I've ever seen.
Yep. That's so funny. He printed a whole bunch out, and then he would, like, I don't know, he would make his friend, like, go deliver these to, like, girls and, like, not girls, but women, like, when they were out and about. I'm like, oh God, so, like, I died when I saw this. He didn't give this to me. I found him in his apartment when we were dating. How funny is that?
How was he not snatched up prior to you
snatching him up?
Because that is adorable. That is exactly the level of adorableness and cheesiness that if I got that card, I would be like, hell yeah, I'm calling you right now.
Yeah, it's...
Hopefully we have something in common, because already your sense of humor, like, I'm in.
Yes.
Marry me now.
Yes.
That's so funny. Oh my gosh. Oh, Armand.
We all need dating cards. I think that would be a really interesting thing. Like, you could get more out of, like, bonafide. A card like this than, like, a dating profile. Like, you'd have to really put a lot of, like, punch into your few inches of space.
No, that's clutch. And if you notice, too, I think that he shelled out the big bucks for those cards, because I know my first business card that I had printed was when I was in grad school. And I just got, you know how, like, on Vistaprint, if you let them put on the back, like, this card was printed with Vistaprint, they'll give you the cards for free. They'll just have you pay for shipping.
Yeah.
Like, so I did that. I remember in grad school, because I was going to conferences and seminars and things, and I needed to give, like, my phone number, my email address to people. And it literally just said, like, you know, Nikki Sear, that's my main last name, Nikki Sear, like, student at SUHS, email, phone number. But on the back, it was, right on the back, it was like, printed for free with Vistaprint.com. And yeah, that is not on the back of his card. It's color, and it's not the cheapo Vistaprint one. So he actually paid top dollar for those cards. I am impressed. That's dedication.
Yep. And double picture, like front, you get the picture.
And I'm noticing that the shape surrounding him on the back looks like it's kind of half of a heart shape.
Yep.
Too.
Yep.
So it's a very subtle reference. He's not like, bam, in your face, you're going to love me.
Right.
It's like a very subtle, like, I'm going to just make you think that this is maybe a heart.
So correct.
Maybe you'll love me. It's very, like, classy and subtle, actually. I'm very impressed. Those of you who are not watching this on YouTube are truly missing out, by the way. Go to the IBS Freedom Podcast YouTube channel and tune in for the last couple minutes of this episode if you want to see Armand's card, because it is magnificent.
Yes. Magnifique.
Tell him I am impressed. Yes.
he would probably be so embarrassed if he found out, but I doubt he'll listen to this, so it doesn't matter.
that's all right. And it's our podcast. We can do what we want.
Right. Right.
Well, speaking of which, I think that was a pretty darn good lowdown on the whole food reintro concept. I think a lot of things to keep in mind, a lot of different ways you can go about reintroducing. I think for most people, honestly, the biggest thing to overcome is just the mindset hurdles and the food fear. And if you can get yourself past that or through it, then I think that you're going to find that the food reintroductions actually go a lot smoother than you otherwise would anticipate. So I hope that all of you listening get to reintroduce some new foods very, very soon, if you have foods to reintroduce, that is.
Yes.
But yeah, but as always, thank you so much for listening. Again, we have this on YouTube in video format, and we have audio-only episodes. If you're on an audio app, if you could rate us 5 stars, that would be super amazing and awesome. And if you are on YouTube, if you can click the like button, the subscribe button, ring the bell, comment. We do fish through the comment section on YouTube so that we have cues for our Q&A episodes. So if you have questions, I encourage you to leave them on YouTube. Particularly, that would be helpful. Or you could email us at ibsfreedompod@gmail.com. Or on Instagram, we are
ibs.freedom.podcast.
Boom. There we go. That's teamwork, making the dream
yes,
work.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Well, we will see you in the next episode when we talk about hydrogen sulfide. Dun, dun, dun.